Benton County is looking for qualified individuals to contribute to the community's growth and development by serving on various advisory boards and committees. The public is encouraged to apply for vacancies in several areas, fostering civic engagement and collaboration. Participation in these advisory bodies provides a unique opportunity for community members to actively contribute to decision-making processes that shape policies and initiatives affecting Benton County. Each vacancy represents a chance for individuals to lend their expertise, perspectives, and insights towards the enhancement of our community. Interested candidates are invited to learn about openings and submit their applications or learn more about advisory boards, commissions, committees, or the application process. Candidates can email pioinfo@bentoncountyor.gov, or there is information posted online at bentoncountyor.gov. Benton County values diversity and encourages individuals from all backgrounds to apply. This recruitment initiative aligns with Benton County's commitment to transparency, community involvement, and informed decision-making. By participating in advisory roles, residents play an integral role in shaping the policies that directly impact our community's well-being and future.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Throughout the day, it's going to be sunny, with highs at 63. Tonight, we'll have clear skies with lows at 38, and the moon in its waning gibbous phase. Tomorrow and Tuesday are going to be sunny as well, with highs in the upper 60s. And by Wednesday, it's expected to cool off fairly significantly, with highs near 50 and a chance of showers. This is KORC.
Here's Vishnu Ramaswamy Sawinski with your pollen count index forecast for today.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Don't call me dude.
Itchy eyes, scratchy throat, runny nose. It's high. Oh, allergy season here in the Willamette Valley. KORC brings you the supplement to the normal weather report with the multi-day pollen forecast. Pollen counts are measured on a relative index scale of 0 to 12. Dudes, things are getting gnarly this weekend, with pollen levels rising to 10.5 on Sunday, while Monday and Tuesday are projected to be in the very high levels of 10.8. Major pollen allergens are currently alder and juniper. Pollen levels are highest in the early mornings and on warm, breezy days. Pollen counts are projected to double by 2040. Total bummer, dude. Due to the increase in CO2 and temperature, leading to the increased growth and longer growing seasons of pollen-producing vegetation. Gesundheit und auf Wiedersehen from your friends here at KORC Corvallis, where the music matters times the speed of light squared.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of April 1st, 2024. On Tuesday, April 2nd at 5 p.m., the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be meeting virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, April 3rd at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will hold a meeting that will be online only. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join. On Thursday, April 4th at 2 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board Work Group Utility Decarbonization will be holding a meeting that will be held virtually. For details on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. Also on Thursday, April 4th at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. And finally, on Saturday, April 6th at 10 a.m. to noon, Corvallis City Councilor for Ward 3, Hyatt Lytle, will be holding Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis Benton County Public Library. Feel free to stop by to say hello and ask questions about local government. 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. In the ongoing dispute between Corvallis leaders and Ward 5 Councillor Charlene Ellis, the city is attempting to stop her lawsuit while the legal fees continue to rack up. Ellis's lawsuit seeks to halt a process that would remove the Corvallis City Councillor from office. A proposed resolution introduced in December accuses her of violating the city charter when she made a motion during a September meeting asking the city manager to fill an open position at City Hall. In her lawsuit, Charlene Ellis argues the charter clause in question violates her free speech rights. The city, on the other hand, claims her motion was an attempt to interfere with the city manager's duties, an accusation that would have her forfeit her seat if a majority of the city council agrees in a vote. The city argues the charter rightfully concerns itself with Ellis's conduct, not her speech. While this might seem confusing, it's important to note, while other issues facing the city are being swept aside, the cost to the taxpayer for this debacle has exceeded $116,000, and the case has been moved to federal court. In a motion filed on March 7th, the City of Corvallis is asking a federal judge to grant it summary judgment in its favor, meaning a request to find that Ellis has no case. In the court filing, the city argues that the charter section in question neither violates the Oregon Constitution nor the First Amendment, and that Ellis, quote, cannot meet her burden of demonstrating that she engaged in protected conduct sufficient to sustain a claim for First Amendment retaliation, unquote. The accusations began this past November, after Councillor Ellis said she was called into a meeting with council leadership and the former city attorney. She was then informed that she had violated Charter Section 23F by directing the city manager twice, once during a city council meeting and previously at a meeting of the Climate Action Advisory Board, which she chairs, to fill a vacant staff position. The position aids in the work of the advisory board. Ellis reportedly agreed to resign but changed her mind later, the city says, and a resolution declaring her seat vacant was pulled from the December 4th council meeting. The city said it would allow her to defend herself at a due process hearing, which was scheduled, and then rescheduled several times before a federal judge officially stopped the city from holding it, pending her litigation. The suit was filed on January 22nd at the Benton County Circuit Court, but the city had the case moved to federal court a couple of weeks later. Beyond the injunction, Ellis asks the court to void the Section 23F altogether because it represents an unconstitutional restraint on speech. In the city's March 7th motion for summary judgment, the city argues that the part of Section 23F of the city charter that calls any attempt to influence or coerce the city manager a violation is constitutional on its face because the language does not focus on the content of speech. Here, the substance or subject of the communication is not an issue. Rather, it is the effect of the speech, attempted influence or coercion, that is the issue, according to the motion. The city's attorneys argue that the influencer or coercion clause in the charter language is narrow enough to survive judicial scrutiny. To violate the cause, the argument says, quote, a councillor must specifically intend to influence or coerce the manager in specific terms, unquote. And this is not protected conduct. The motion also argues that Ellis's speech was not protected as the speech was incompatible with her official function. Quote, here, the impaired responsibility is of a city councillor not to violate the separation of power principles clearly laid out in the charter by usurping the manager's authority over hiring decisions, unquote. The motion reads. With regards to Ellis's claims of First Amendment retaliation, the motion argues similarly by saying, quote, because the, quote, influence or coercion clause, unquote, is neither unconstitutionally overbroad in every conceivable action, nor prohibits such a broad range of conduct as to be unconstitutionally overbroad, it is not facially invalid. The clause, the motion argues, leaves, quote, ample avenues for communication for city councilors who wish to communicate with the manager regarding staff or hiring matters, unquote. While councilors have First Amendment protections, the city's legal papers say making motions, which is a mechanism of city government, is not expressive conduct and not entitled to those protections. The motion asked the judge to grant the city relief and then dismiss all of Ellis's claims with prejudice. Since this case began in December, the city has incurred, through the month of February, $116,000 and counting in legal fees. Back in December, on advice of the former city attorneys, the council voted 7-2 to hire an outside firm to take up the charter violation case, allowing the city attorney's office to remain in an advisory role throughout the case for fairness. Both Ellis and Councilor Paul Schaefer voted no on the motion. The city contracted a Portland-based law firm to handle the case. A special thanks goes out to Cosiso Uguede and the Corvallis Gazette-Times for information provided in this report. Their website is gazettetimes.com. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. KORC is welcoming another episode of Democracy Now! With international and national news. For more information, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There was an insurrection.
Shame on you, Joe Biden! Shame on you! Shame on you! You are genocide of Palestine!
As President Biden holds the largest one-night fundraiser in presidential campaign history, with Presidents Obama and Clinton at his side, raising over $25 million, protesters chanted inside and outside Radio City Music Hall here in New York. We'll hear some of their voices, then to Gaza, to talk to UNICEF spokesperson James Elder.
When I was there, I saw a room full of mothers and carers, not always mothers, some mothers have been killed, carers shuddering over children who are paper thin, absolutely paper thin, incubators full of babies who are born prematurely because of the stress on mothers, also malnourished.
But first, the remains of two of the six workers killed in the Key Bridge collapse are recovered.
The victims were identified as Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, 35 years old, of Baltimore, and Dorlin Raniel Castillo Cabrera, 26 years old, of Dundalk.
We'll speak with the head of CASA, an immigrant rights group in Baltimore. He knew some of the men who died. Two of their members were killed, a Salvadoran father of three and a Honduran father of two. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to ensure unhindered aid can get into Gaza. The legally binding order was issued after a request by South Africa, which brought the genocide case against Israel to the ICJ in January. The court noted in its latest order, quote, Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but famine is setting in, they said. The judges also cite UN data, which finds, quote, at least 31 people, including 27 children, having already died of malnutrition and dehydration, unquote. Israel's required to submit a report to the ICJ in a month showing how it has implemented the order. In northern Gaza, where the UN warns famine is imminent, the Kamal Adwan Hospital is seeing an increasing number of extremely underweight babies and children. This is Nurse Ahmed Al-Ali.
We received this case about an hour ago, a malnutrition case. We got used to receiving such cases daily. She is suffering as a result of a lack of nutrients she's receiving. You can tell that her age doesn't match her weight. She's 2 months old, and yet she's only 2 kilos and some fractions. My shift in the intensive care does not go without 3 or 4 cases of this kind, from bad to worse, and the result is death.
The official death toll in Gaza has now topped 32,600. In Syria, Israeli airstrikes near Aleppo killed some 40 people, according to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. State media reports civilians are among the dead and injured. The attacks struck missile depots used by Hezbollah and reportedly killed at least 5 Hezbollah fighters. Israel and Hezbollah have engaged in near daily skirmishes across the Israel-Lebanon border since October 7th. Hebrew University in Jerusalem has reinstated Professor Nedra Shalhoub Kevorkian, the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian professor who was suspended earlier this month after saying in an interview Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. Hebrew University reportedly did not demand she recount those remarks, but did reinstate her after she clarified her remarks on reports of sexual assaults during the October 7th attacks. Her suspension had been met with protests from students and faculty of the school. You can see our interview with Nedra Shalhoub Kevorkian at democracynow.org. Here in New York, President Biden appeared with former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton in a massive campaign fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall Thursday night. The star-studded event featured musical performances, and the conversation with the three presidents was moderated by The Late Show host Stephen Colbert. Outside the venue, thousands of activists gathered to protest U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza.
It's an issue of them funding and facilitating this genocide that's carried out by Israel. They are supporting the death of over 40,000 people, and this is not the first time they've supported death and war. And people are sick of that. People are going hungry in this city. People don't have a place to sleep. And all the while, we're sending billions of dollars to Israel to kill Palestinians and to steal their land.
Inside the event, the largest presidential campaign fundraiser in history, activists repeatedly disrupted Biden's conversation, shouting, "Stop arming Israel, let Gaza live, and shame on you." We'll hear more of those voices later in the broadcast. A new Gallup poll found that 55% of Americans disapprove of Israel's military actions in Gaza, up 10 percentage points from November. Earlier in the day, activists held a vigil on the steps of New York City Hall. Organized by the Slow Factory, activists read out names of Palestinians killed since October 7th. This is Vivian Sansour from the Palestine Heirloom Seed Library.
The soil has become so toxic because of the amount of bombs, from white phosphorus to all kinds of other ammunition, and the infrastructure was destroyed, so there's also sewage, there's so many diseases. So a lot of our trees, which for us, our trees are part of our family, they are part of our kin, and they are being destroyed too.
In voting news, a federal court ruled South Carolina can use a Republican gerrymandered congressional map for the upcoming U.S. House election. This despite the same court ruling last year it was unconstitutional and that it exiled more than 30,000 black residents from the Charleston area district. The U.S. Supreme Court has yet to issue a decision on the ruling's challenge, allowing it to stay in place at least through the 2024 elections. The seat is currently held by the Trump-endorsed Congressmember Nancy Mace, who's running for re-election. Meanwhile, in Florida, a federal court allowed a gerrymandered map that sidelines black voters to remain in place. The map was created in 2022 after Republican Governor Ron DeSantis set out to dismantle the Northern District of former Congressmember Al Lawson, a black Democrat. In other voting news, a Texas Court of Appeals has reversed the conviction of Crystal Mason, a black woman who faced 5 years in prison for submitting a provisional ballot in 2016, even though she was barred from voting due to a past felony conviction. Mason was unaware she was not eligible to vote, and the provisional ballot was never counted as a vote. Crystal Mason celebrated the win Thursday, saying, quote, "I was thrown into this fight for voting rights and will keep swinging to ensure no one else has to face what I've endured for over 6 years, a political ploy where minority voting rights are under attack," she said. To see our interview with Crystal Mason, go to democracynow.org. The Biden administration's restored a series of wildlife protections under the Endangered Species Act that were rolled back under President Trump. This includes reinstating certain protections for species classified as threatened with extinction and taking into greater consideration the threat of climate change when issuing protections. Sam Bankman-Fried, the disgraced founder of the now-defunct cryptocurrency exchange FTX, was sentenced to 25 years in prison for fraud and conspiracy. District Judge Lewis Kaplan noted Bankman-Fried's, quote, "apparent lack of any remorse," unquote, for defrauding FTX customers out of at least $8 billion. Bankman-Fried's lawyer said they plan to appeal. A federal judge has tossed Elon Musk's lawsuit against the watchdog Center for Countering Digital Hate, writing in his ruling, quote, "This case is about punishing the defendants for their speech." Elon Musk sued the nonprofit after they reported that hate speech, racism, and misinformation soared on the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, after the billionaire took ownership of the site in 2022. The Center for Countering Digital Hate welcomed the lawsuit's dismissal, writing on X, quote, "We'll continue exposing hate and lies on X and campaigning for social media bosses like Musk to be held accountable." To see our interview about this case with the head of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, go to democracynow.org. Colombia has expelled its Argentine diplomats as tensions between the Argentine president Javier Milei and his leftist Latin American counterparts reach new heights this week. Excerpts from a new CNN interview with Milei show the right-wing leader lashing out at Colombian President Gustavo Petro and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and attacking Venezuela and Cuba.
The butchery in Venezuela is unheard of. Same with the jail that is Cuba. There are other cases that are on their way to becoming like Venezuela, such as Colombia with Mr. Petro. We cannot expect much from someone who was a murderer, terrorist, and communist.
President Milei was referencing Colombian President Petro's history as a former member of the M19 rebel movement. Milei also called López Obrador ignorant. Among other things, the leaders are at odds over their support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Milei is a staunch supporter of Israel, while Petro earlier this week threatened to sever diplomatic ties with Israel if it ignores the UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And Saudi Arabia was chosen to chair the UN Commission on the Status of Women. Rights groups expressed outrage at the news. Amnesty International's Deputy Director of Advocacy, Shireen Tadros, said, quote, Saudi Arabia's abysmal record when it comes to protecting and promoting the rights of women puts a spotlight on the vast gulf between the lived reality for women and girls in Saudi Arabia and the aspirations of the commission, unquote. Earlier this week, Amnesty International released a report condemning a leaked draft of Saudi Arabia's first written penal code, which Amnesty says criminalizes free speech, homosexuality, and abortion, and fails to protect women and girls from all forms of gender-based violence. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Baltimore, where divers have recovered the remains of two of the six workers who were missing and presumed dead after the Key Bridge was struck by a massive cargo ship Tuesday and collapsed under them without warning. The men were migrants from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. They were filling potholes and had reportedly taken a break in their vehicles. This is Maryland State Police Superintendent Roland Butler.
Shortly before 10 a.m., divers located a red pickup truck submerged in approximately 25 feet of water in the area of the middle span of the bridge. Divers recovered two victims of this tragedy trapped within the vehicle. The victims were identified as Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, 35 years old, of Baltimore, and Dorlin Raniel Castillo Cabrera, 26 years old, of Dundalk.
Since the bridge collapsed, just two workers' bodies have been recovered.
Mis amores, reina de mis días, te entregué todos mis temores, te entregué toda la vida, te cultivé como un árbol bien plantado, te eché agua todos los días. Pero no echaste raíces, y esas flores eran de mentira. Oye, amor de mis amores, qué trampa es la vida. Voy a morir llorando, voy a morir sufriendo.
Love of My Loves by Making Movies in Florida, Tolo Wachi. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
That was the latest segment of Democracy Now! With national and international news. For more information, visit democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
Thanks for joining us today for KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. The Benton County Fairgrounds Auditorium is going to transform into a dentistry office for one weekend thanks to Oregon State University's Pre-Dental Club and Caring Hands Worldwide. This free clinic will be by appointment only on April 13th and 14th, with services ranging from regular cleanings to fillings and extractions for those who cannot afford private dental insurance. Caring Hands Worldwide is an organization that aims to improve the dental health of those in need while partnering with them to strengthen their communities. According to Carla Hernandez, who is the volunteer coordinator of the OSU Pre-Dentistry Club, the event has taken place every April since 2022, thanks to the Pre-Dentistry Club, Caring Hands Worldwide, Oregon Health Sciences University dental students, and Cam Little, who is a local dentist in Corvallis. Hernandez said that student volunteers will be able to provide translation for Spanish-speaking attendees, and that she hopes the clinic can benefit as many Benton County residents as possible. Appointments can be made by texting 541-556-5902. That's the free clinic, by appointment, April 13th and 14th, with services for those who cannot afford private dental insurance. The phone number again to text for more information is 541-556-5902. This is KORC.
Listening to KORC News, Music, and Civic. The Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, a remote expanse of wilderness along the California-Oregon border, will not lose any of its acreage after the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday declined to take up two challenges to its expansion. Logging interests in several counties in Oregon had asked the High Court to strike down a 2017 addition to the monument. Their lawsuit claimed President Barack Obama improperly made the designation because Congress had previously set aside the land for timber harvests. By gaining monument status, the area won special protections, including a prohibition on logging. The challenges to the expansion raised the additional and broader question of whether the president's authority to create national monuments unilaterally under the Antiquities Act should be restricted. Critics of the 1906 law, who have commonly opposed bids for new designations, have argued it gives too much power to the executive branch. The Supreme Court decided not to address the issue. Quote, "The monument and its expansion, it's now the law of the land," unquote, said Kristen Boyles, an attorney for Earth Justice, which represents groups supporting the expansion of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. The Cascade Siskiyou National Monument was created in 2000 to protect what is considered an ecologically valuable juncture of the ancient Siskiyou Mountains and the younger volcanic Cascades. The area, because of its diversity, contains a unique mix of plants and wildlife, from cactus to old-growth fir forests and desert snakes to salamanders. The monument was expanded by 48,000 acres 7 years ago. The now 114,000-acre monument, while remote and less visited than other federal lands, is popular for fishing, hunting, hiking, skiing, and snowmobiling. While most of the monument is in Oregon, about 5,000 acres reside in California, adjacent to the state's Horseshoe Ranch Wildlife Area. The petitions against the monument's expansion were filed by the American Forest Resource Council, a trade group representing logging companies, alongside a coalition of Oregon counties and the Murphy Company, a timber supplier. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, it was reported that they argued about the Antiquities Act and that it couldn't trump federal regulation to preserve timber harvests on Oregon and California railroad revested lands known as O and C lands. The federal lands were originally devoted to building a railroad between San Francisco and Portland, but were later conveyed back to the government with conditions. At stake for logging companies with the monument designation, millions of board feet of timber that could be harvested there. The counties on ONC lands stood to lose a cut of the revenue from timber sales. Quote, "We're disappointed the Supreme Court did not take this historic opportunity to provide balance to growing executive overreach on federal lands through the Antiquities Act and legal clarity for our forests, communities, and the people who steward them," unquote, said Travis Joseph, president of the American Forest Resource Council, in a statement. The challenges were previously denied in two separate appellate court rulings. Thank you, Associated Press, for this story. National Monument on California-Oregon border will remain intact after surviving legal challenge. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of April 1st, 2024. On Tuesday, April 2nd at 5 p.m., the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be meeting virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. On Wednesday, April 3rd at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will hold a meeting that will be online only. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join. On Thursday, April 4th at 2 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board Workgroup Utility Decarbonization will be holding a meeting that will be held virtually. For details on how to join the meeting, see CorvallisOregon.gov. Also on Thursday, April 4th at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. And finally, on Saturday, April 6th at 10 a.m. to noon, Corvallis City Councilor for Ward 3, Hyatt Lytle, will be holding Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. Feel free to stop by to say hello and ask questions about local government. 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. As we continue to cover the 2024 election, we turn our attention to the Benton County Board of Commissioners race, where two local community members are vying for the spot. One of them, Liz Irish, is a loan officer and County Planning Commission member, and the other is Gabe Shepherd, Corvallis City Council member and chair of the Benton County Democrats, among other things. In order for both candidates to get equal airtime, I will be sitting down with both. This week, though, I had the opportunity to sit down with Gabe to talk about his campaign. Gabe made his first official dive into representative democracy in 2020 when he ran for and won a seat on the Corvallis City Council. Since then, while representing Ward 4, he has been part of a council that made its way through the pandemic, oversaw several land annexations for new housing, and the transition to a new mayor. His journey into politics began years before he was elected, while he was a student at Oregon State University, but I'll let him tell that story. Here's my interview with Gabe Shepherd, recorded during a sunny afternoon at New Morning Bakery. Let's listen.
All right.
Tell us a little about yourself, where you grew up, etc.
Yeah, so I grew up in Junction City, just outside of Junction City in Cheshire. The third generation graduate from Junction City High School. My mom and my grandfather both graduated from there. I grew up rural. I did 4-H, had goats, two Nubians and two Oberhosleys, and took care of them for a long time. And graduated valedictorian from Junction City High School in 2014 and decided to come here to OSU. I did robotics for 4 years in high school, FTC, decided to come to OSU for a degree in engineering.
How'd you get into politics?
Yeah, so I was not interested in politics at all for a long time, up until the 2016 presidential election, and the Bernie Sanders campaign got me really interested in, you know, progressive politics that come from a grassroots level, and I was very interested in that. And when the whole election didn't go the way that I wanted or I was expecting, I heeded what Senator Sanders said, which was get involved locally. And I started going to every city council meeting in Corvallis. You can ask counselors from them. They'd see me in the back. I'd sit in the back and listen because I wanted to know what was going on in my community, and I wanted to share that with other people. So that's, 2016 is what activated me as a political activist.
What was that activation like? Do you remember kind of feelings you felt? And
yeah, it was a weird transition. I went from not being interested in politics at all to reading Politico almost every day, and just staying up to date on how delegates were being apportioned in the primary. And there's a picture of this out there somewhere, but I was walking around campus with I think it was May 16th, the primary date in 2016, with a little sign that said, "Don't forget to vote." And at least one person turned around and went home to get their ballot because they forgot their ballot at home. So I know I got at least one person to vote, but I was, I'm not afraid to look like a fool for democracy. It was a big change from not caring or wanting to get involved at all to, like, this is what I'm focusing on now and where I'm putting a lot of my energy.
Yeah, so you got interested in politics on 2016. So then could you describe your journey then into getting more active in Corvallis and Albany politics?
Yeah, so I, like I said, I went to every single Corvallis City Council meeting starting in about 2017. I got really involved there, and after a few years, I approached Mayor Traber and asked him, where would you see me fitting on any of these boards and commissions? How can I volunteer and get more involved? And he said, I actually think we have a special thing that would work great for you. And I became the volunteer aide to the Corvallis City Legislative Committee. It's four councilors and the mayor, and they take preliminary positions on state and federal legislation, and often refer it to the full council for a vote of support or writing a letter or something like that, advocating for that legislation. I tracked bills for them. I would give a report. The counselors would be very appreciative. They were very appreciative of the work I was doing. After a while, I started taking minutes at some of those meetings because the city recorder wasn't available, and that kind of got me into what's become my professional career, which is municipal clerks, city recorders, and doing that kind of work. I became a contracted minutes recorder for the cities of Corvallis, Albany, and Newport, for a few years, and that's what was my pandemic job. I was taking minutes for those cities, for their boards and councils and things like that. And I got to know how local governments worked across our region. In 2019, Mayor Traber appointed me to the Budget Commission. And in 2020, I ran for Corvallis City Council and was elected.
Now, what made you decide to run for Benton County Commissioner?
Yeah, so a few things. I'm interested in policy, and I'm interested in taking a broad perspective, a broad view on policy issues. Benton County Commissioner, being a county commissioner is a unique position in politics. It is a full-time position where you get to deep dive into advocacy for your community and policy work. You are a manager, you are a legislator, and it is your full-time job to represent the community. And that sounds like a dream job to me. It's not everybody's dream job, but it is for me. Right now, my day job, my volunteer work, I'm the chair of the Benton County Democrats, I'm a Corvallis City Councilor, so all of this is like, that's what I spend my time doing already, and to be able to focus that in and have it be a full-time position, like, that's a dream job. And of course, there's policy things that I think the county needs to be working on that, urged me to run. And I can talk about those policies all day, but, the personal decision of why I wanted to run, it is a dream job.
Yeah, and so would it then? How would your other jobs come into play? Would it be a singular focus then, or would you still have time for, like, the chair of the Benton County Democrats?
Well, so since being a county commissioner is a full-time position, I currently work for the City of Albany. I'm their deputy city clerk. I would leave that position, I would leave that position. I would no longer be a Corvallis City Councilor. The end of my current City Council term abuts the beginning of the County Commission term I'm running for, so it's a pretty seamless transition there. And Chair of the Benton County Democrats, that's something I'm still interested in doing for at least a few more years. There's a lot of work I think the local party has to do in advocacy, outreach, and restructuring.
Yeah, you'd be leaving the Corvallis City Council since being elected in 2020. How has that experience shaped and prepared you for a commissioner position?
Yeah, the experience of being an elected official is... it's something that you don't know until you're there. People have a lot of expectations on you, of you, and you're human, which is, it's a joke I say that until I started attending Corvallis City Council meetings, I didn't realize that politicians were just people. I'd see Mayor Traber around town, and I'm like, that's the mayor! And I'm like, he lives here. He's a guy. He lives here. He gets groceries. And he cares about his community and serves.
It kind of personalizes politics.
Yeah. And so, but being an elected official, it comes with a responsibility to oversee budgets, to oversee staff. The way staff is overseen at a city level is different than at a county level. So that will be a transition, but it's one I think is going to be easy. But I think that it's important that county commissioners, which are a higher level of elected official than city councilors, that you go into that knowing what it's like to have the public mad at you about something and blame you personally, whether it's your fault personally or not. Ability to sit through community comments where people attack you and be able to sit through the hard times and oversee in the good times. So I think that it's really prepared me for being a county commissioner.
Now I want to shift to some of your priorities. It says on your website that, quote, many people feel disconnected from the decisions that take place at the county level. One of your priorities is building public engagement with all of Benton County's communities. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so the county commission, because county commissioners are full-time paid positions, county commissions in general meet during work days. It's a very common practice across the state. And it's something that I find concerning as a city councilor. You know, in Corvallis, we have a lot of people come to us and talk to us during councilor or business from the public, public comments, that kind of thing. It is hard for people in our community to come to a county commission meeting at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday and tell the commissioners that they have concerns about a project or that they're supportive of a project. So it allows the county to be in its, to act without as much community input as our local councils. So one of my policy positions is to have at least one meeting a month that is after typical work hours, so after 5 p.m., a meeting where we can solicit community input. I'm also committed to a town hall in every city, every year, every community. I want to have a town hall in all five of our incorporated cities and LC, Kings Valley, Wren. Like, I want to be out in the community every year and hold these town halls. And that's one of the things that earned me the endorsement of former Congressman Peter DeFazio, was a focus on public engagement and holding town halls.
How has that public engagement, what was that experience like for you while on the council?
Yeah, it is hard to be as engaged as I want to be on the Corvallis City Council because I have a full-time day job, which makes it difficult to have the capacity to hold or plan town halls, community events, things like that. I try my best to be out at as many events as I'm invited to as a city councilor, going to events held by local groups, neighborhood associations, or the Sustainability Coalition, things like that. I try and be out as much as I can be in the community, which is why I think that there's an opportunity for county commissioners to be totally and fully engaged because it is their full-time job. And that's one of the reasons why public engagement is so important to me is for this race specifically, is there's a real opportunity for county commissioners to be fully engaged members of the community across the county.
Okay, let's talk about climate action.
Yeah.
What has been your experience with combating climate change? How will you make it a priority at the county level?
Yeah, I think that so climate action is something that's very near and dear to me. It's very important to me as a candidate and as an elected official. When I first ran for city council in 2020, I was walking to the county courthouse to submit my voter's pamphlet statement, and the sky was orange and red with smoke as it was September of 2020 when there were massive wildfires across the state. And that's a moment I'll remember for the rest of my political career. Is the first time I ran for office, I got a visual confirmation of why climate action is so important. I think the county has an opportunity to be a leader on climate action in the state. I think we have a community in Corvallis and broader Benton County that cares a lot about climate action. And I think that the county could step up in a few ways to represent that passion. I think the county can look at its climate action plan and update it. Right now, the county's climate action plan is 2 pages. And it lists things that are mostly operational and internal county functions. And I really think there's an opportunity to look at things from a broader perspective. Also, you know, the county really needs to focus in on climate mitigation as well. We have people out in outside of Monroe, out in South County, that their wells are running dry, and they have real concerns about new development, new buildings out where they live, because there's not water right now to support it. So I think that the county really needs to look at about how it's supporting our rural residents in making sure wells don't run dry and protecting people from wildfires.
Okay, you've been involved in Corvallis politics for several years. You went to college here before that, which means you've lived here for a long time and have probably seen the difficulties people have with being able to afford to live here. Affordable housing is on your priority list as well. So what is your commitment like to providing housing that is safe, affordable, and accessible, especially for low-income folks?
Yeah. Housing is so important. You know, as a renter here in town, it is so hard to find housing that is affordable. You know, affordability is a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot. There's actual definitions of it. There's a difference between subsidized housing and affordable housing, but I believe the statistic is that your average worker should pay about 30% of their monthly income on housing, and that's what's considered affordable. So that, you know, that's different for a two-income family or a one-income family or a parent with a child. You know, these are all different levels of income and different levels of what's considered affordable. The county has less oversight over housing code and policy than cities do. But there are opportunities for the county to, again, be a leader on this. I think that the county's a perfect entity to convene local jurisdictions to come together and say, where can we put housing for the next 5 years, so it's not incumbent upon Corvallis to only be the ones who are infilling or building or just Adair Village to explode in population. Where can we reasonably and thoughtfully site new housing? And there's opportunities as well with housing on farmland. There are some serious restrictions right now on where farmers can and how many farmhand houses farmers can build, and I think that's a real opportunity to allow people to live where they work. There's an opportunity for the county to reevaluate our restrictions on that. And you know, I have been proud of my record on the city council of supporting housing. You know, I've supported many annexations into the city that are going to expand the amount of housing units we have in the city. We have the most subsidized or most affordable housing being built right now. I believe it's like 405 units, something like that, in city history. And so this is, you know, this council has been very aware of and focused on doing what is within our power to alleviate the housing crisis in Corvallis and the broader Benton County area.
Okay, we've talked a bit and we're getting an idea of who you are.
All right.
I'd like to expand on that, on who you are and your values, and ask simply, what guides you in your decision making? Like, what are your values?
Yeah, you know, I think doing the most for the most people you care is important. My family, you know, I grew up in a family that is very very focused and bent on service. My mother is a public school teacher for over 30 years. My father is a longtime volunteer with Egan Warming Shelter in Eugene, and my mother now runs the site that is at our the church that I grew up in Eugene. And like, service to those. Service is very important to my family, and it's a value that they've instilled in me and my brother, and is getting passed along to my nephews. And I, I value public service. I could have been an engineer. I graduated with honors in from OSU with a degree in industrial engineering, but what made me feel more fulfilled was public service. And so I left the potential of a high-earning engineering job to become a public servant.
All right. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, I just want to plug my website real quick, gabeshepherd.com, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D. You can see on there the list of supporters and endorsers that I have. You can read more about my campaign. I'm very proud to have be the only candidate supported by League of Conservation Voters. We were talking about climate earlier. And our local council of AFL-CIO. I have support from across the county, which has been really encouraging to go out. I have support from current and former councilors from Corvallis, Monroe, Philomath, and Albany. A list of support that just... It makes me... it's always surprising, but it reminds me of just like, yeah, I've been doing a lot recently. I've been out there in the community working, and people have seen it, and they're supporting me for county commissioner. We have more donors than I believe any candidate who's ever run for this office. We've just passed 100 individual donors, and we've raised, as of last week, we've raised more money than any candidate who's ever run for this office. And I'm so excited to keep this campaign going and meet people on the doors and see people in May. Remember to vote by May 21st.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking with me, Gabe.
Thank you so much.
That was Gabe Shepherd, current Corvallis City Council member and candidate for position 2 of the Benton County Commissioners. The primaries will be held in May, and the general elections will occur this November. Voters' pamphlets for the primaries will be available to view online towards the end of April. This is Nick Martin with KORC.
Make sure to tune in to KORC 105.9 Corvallis and KORCFM.com on the internet for
Adventures on the Dragonfly Pinky Toe.
Join me, Captain Galaxy, and my crew,
Xander the Goblin,
and Allie in the Galley,
and Ray in the Bay,
and Lexan Winbrook,
and me, Tiny Ursus,
for Adventures on the Dragonfly Pinky Toe.
Sunday nights at 11 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m.